open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I think this story of these nine young Americans who climbed in this boat and learned to pull together is an almost perfect metaphor for what that whole generation of Americans did.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Author Daniel James Brown writes books that bring dramatic historical events to blazing, vivid life. His latest book, The Boys in the Boat, tells the story of the American rowing team that won a gold medal at Hitler's 1936 Berlin Olympics. Brown says he learned that to be a great crew member, you need an ego that is both big and small.
It's a pretty audacious thing to want to become an Olympic rower. You have to have a lot of self-confidence and belief in yourself. But crew is all about melding in with others and becoming part of something larger than yourself. And that requires that you subsume your ego. And so you have to have these very interesting kinds of personalities that are capable of both.
The Boys in the Boat has been on the New York Times bestseller list and the Los Angeles Times list as well for many weeks, with a film adaptation currently in development. Daniel James Brown spoke with Lucas Whitman, formerly the books editor at the Daily Beast and now an editor at the publishing house Reagan Arts in New York City. Brown starts off our conversation telling Whitman how he came to write this amazing story.
Actually, the story came to me, literally. It walked into my living room one day about 6 years ago. In my neighborhood, we have these horrible homeowners association meetings where we are compelled to get together and argue with each other over weighty issues like what color you may or may not paint your mailbox. And we get into just horrible things over this. And unfortunately, it was at my house 6 years ago. But actually, it turned out to be fortunate, because after that meeting, one of my neighbors, a lady I knew only as Judy at the time, came up to me, and she said she had been reading one of my previous books to her dad, and he was enjoying that. But he was in the last couple months of his life living under hospice care. And because he was enjoying the book, she asked if I would come down and meet him. And as she was going out the door, she mentioned something about rowing and an Olympic gold medal, but it just sort of went right over my head. So I think it was the next day. I went down to Judy's house, and I met this elderly gentleman named Joe Rance. And Joe was very weak. He was stretched out on a recliner. He was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. And we talked a little bit about that earlier book.
How old was he?
He was 93 or 94 at the time. We talked a little bit about that earlier book, and then he began to talk about his experience growing up during the Great Depression. And he had this particularly poignant story to tell about his family circumstances, and that actually wound up becoming a very important part of the book. But then he began to talk about how he came to row crew at the University of Washington starting in the fall of 1933, and how ultimately he and his crewmates had wound up rowing in Berlin for a gold medal, rowing against, amongst others, a German boat in front of Hitler and Goebbels and Goering and all the top Nazis. And, you know, as he told me this tale, I just became absolutely mesmerized by it. And I wound up that same day. I didn't go down there looking for a book topic at all, and I don't usually jump on a book topic that easily, but I was hooked right away. And so I asked him that day, I said, Joe, can I write a book about your life? And I really put it the wrong way, because he immediately shook his head and said, no, I don't want you to write a book about my life. And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, but you could write a book about the boat. And by the boat, of course, he meant himself and his crew members, and really more than just his crew members. He really meant this almost perfect thing that they had all become together, this beautiful thing that they had become together that afternoon in Berlin 75 years before. And so that really affected me, and that was the spirit in which I set out to write the book.
And who were these boys?
You know, these were kids that grew up in mill towns and on dairy farms around Western Washington State. They were kids that grew strong with pitchforks and axes, and they were a pretty rough and tumble bunch of kids. Mm-hmm. Part of what's interesting about them is that to get where they wanted to go, they had to grow against kids who were from entirely different kinds of life circumstances. The Ivy League kids from, you know, schools back east, and then beyond them, they had to row against kids from Oxford and Cambridge, mm-hmm. kids who in some cases were literally aristocrats, and then ultimately this Nazi crew. So they were underdogs pretty much the whole way through this odyssey that they set out on.
And underdogs in a time when America was full of underdogs.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the appeal of the story is that these were kids anybody could identify with, and Americans did identify with them because they were, for lack of a better term, they were blue-collar kids. And those hard times, it was easy to feel that you had a kinship with them and to invest yourself in their endeavors and their exploits. So they were appealing bunch of kids.
I think one of the more moving parts is that at a time now when the U.S. Olympic, as we saw recently, there's a lot of money that goes into the Olympics, and literally these boys had to kind of scrimp and save and raise money to go, to pay for their way to the Olympics.
Yeah, well, part of what an interesting stop along the journey of this on their way to Berlin was that when the day that they won the right to become Team USA and go to Berlin and row, a couple hours after they won that right in a race, a gentleman named Henry Penn Burke from the Pennsylvania Athletic Club came to them, and he said, congratulations, but I hope you know your boys need to pay their own way. And none of these boys had two nickels to rub together, and the school didn't have any money to send them to Berlin, and nobody had told them that they would have to fund their own way. So this was a terrible blow. And then Burke went on to say, Penn came in second, and actually we've got plenty of money, and so it's not a problem, we'll just go in your place. And so that night, Coach Ulbrichsen, the Washington coach, and the press contingent that was traveling with these kids from Washington, they got on the phones, and phones started ringing back in Seattle that night, and they rang deep into the night. And by the next morning, there were organizing committees, and by that afternoon, there were hundreds of Seattleites out on the street corner selling these little paper badges for 50 cents apiece. And within 48 hours, they raised $5,000, which in the midst of the Depression was an enormous amount of money, and they wired it east, and these guys were good to go to Berlin. But it's really only because the people of Seattle, you know,
gathered around them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Joe Rantz, because he is the central character in the book. And he's that kind of character that, as a writer, you must have sort of come home after you first met him and think, oh my God, what have I got here?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the moment I met Joe, I felt enormous empathy for him, for one thing. Partly just for a very personal reason. My own father died in the fall of, my father's father died in the fall of 1929, the same month that Joe's family abandoned him. And so my own father's family's situation deteriorated right at the beginning of the Depression. So as Joe was telling me that part of his story, I felt an immediate personal connection. But you know, as I got to know Joe better over the next few months, he turned out to be one of the kindest and most generous people I have ever met. He was extraordinary. He was so positive in the way he looked at the world. He had all these very difficult circumstances to overcome in his childhood, and yet he remained extremely optimistic and positive through the whole story, and then into old age. He was just a very forward-looking man, and that made a big impression on me. I mean, became a huge admirer of his.
Yeah. He was, I mean, it's incredible that you sort of go through what he had to overcome just to even walk into, through the doors, through the gates of the University of Washington.
Yeah. You know, the University of Washington was his sort of passport to a better life, as it was for a number of young people during the Depression. He really wanted to get a college degree, specifically an engineering degree, so that he could marry Joyce, his long-term girlfriend. And the only way he could afford to go to the university was if he got on the crew, because as long as he was on the crew, they would guarantee him a part-time job somewhere on campus. And that was what he was living off of. So he had to get on the crew, and then he had to stay on the crew. And it was very hard. There were hundreds of kids competing for places in just a few boats. So the psychological pressure on Joe was enormous through this whole period, just trying to stay on that crew so that he could stay in, stay at the university.
Yeah. And you, one thing that struck me was how different in a way college sports was then too, in that, you know, it was a sort of, they were all amateurs. None of the, I don't think any of the boys at the University of Washington crew had ever rowed before, really. Or
no.
Maybe, you know, sort of with a rowboat or something, but they hadn't crewed before.
Exactly.
And there was no sports scholarships or anything like that?
There were no, at least for rowing, there were no scholarships, no.
Right.
The best they could do was a part-time job. And even, you know, they, Joe and all these other kids, they worked hard during the summers to save up enough money to at least partially get them through another school year.
Right.
But we forget how incredibly tough it was to get any kind of job in the Depression.
Yeah.
So, and actually, Joe wound up working on the Grand Coulee Dam out in eastern Washington.
Right. Hanging?
Hanging by ropes
face.
From a cliff, on a cliff face, with a jackhammer in his hands, pounding away at the rock face of this cliff. Day after day, and I forget what the wages they paid him were, but it was
75 cents an hour?
Something like that, yeah. And
I don't know what that is in today's money, but it's not a lot.
Not a whole lot, no. And it's really, you know, it's very hot out there. It's a tough environment. Just being out there is tough. So that's the kind of thing they had to do in order to get a little money together and try to get through another year at school.
Right. And meanwhile, all the boys on the East Coast at Cornell and Harvard and Yale, they were all coming from prep schools where they had rowed, and they
yeah.
were kind of...
Yeah, these guys, these Washington kids, when they showed up at the Shell House, they didn't know one end of an oar from another, basically. And the kids that they would ultimately have to row against and defeat, as you say, many of them learned to row in prep schools, the more elite prep schools in the East. And they were also kids who had enormous, in many cases, enormous financial resources, so they weren't having to work, you know, on the Grand Coulee Dam during the summer and scrubbing out locker rooms during the school year. So there was an enormous disparity in their economic circumstances.
And do you think that helped make them as a team, as a crew?
I do, actually. Without getting carried away with it, these kids from Washington, as I say, they grew up on farms or in mill towns, so they were used to working with their hands. They were used to working outdoors, and then when they began to row, kids in the East in the winter, they can't row on the rivers in the East because they freeze up, and so they row in tanks during the winter indoors. The kids out in Washington State could row all winter, but they had to row out on Lake Washington, and believe me, I've been out there. It's windy and cold and sleety and nasty out on Lake Washington in February. But these kids rowed all winter long. And so I think these kinds of experiences, when it came time, for instance, for that gold medal race in Berlin, they were used to rough conditions. They were used to hardship. And I do think it gave them an advantage.
And I guess also the other thing I was thinking that they also, as it were, came together and learned to row together, whereas the others maybe learned to row with different styles
yeah.
or in different boats or with different crew members, and they were all kind of forged together rather than
yeah.
kind of separately.
Yeah, this crew came together over the period of 3 years, basically. And, you know, it's a very important distinction, being a crew as opposed to being eight men or eight women in a boat. Part of the interest of rowing for me was, and I didn't know any of this when I started the project, a rowing coach, Bob Ernst, the director of rowing at Washington, told me he would never just take the strongest man or the strongest woman in his boat and clone that man or woman and have eight identical, very strong rowers. Rowing is a little bit mysterious. Putting a crew together is a little bit mysterious. There's a kind of alchemy to it. And it involves mixing and matching different physical types in different positions in the boat, and also different personality types. And so there was this, you know, part of the intrigue of the story of this crew is that they didn't really come together until in the spring of 1936. There came a day when Coach Al Ulbrichtsen, he'd been trying to get this perfect boat to go to Berlin, the best boat he could put together, and it just, he had a boat that was the leading contender, but it just wasn't turning in the kinds of times he knew he would need. And there came a day when he put Joe Rantz in at number 7. And Ulbrichtsen's logbooks are actually kept in the Special Collections Archives at the University of Washington. And so I looked through those. The day they dropped Joe Rantz into the number 7 seat in that boat, it took off with an extraordinarily improved times. And basically, from then on, every time they went out, it got better and better and better. And it wasn't that Joe was such an extraordinary oarsman. It's just that he was the right oarsman. He was the other kids in the boat trusted him. They understood him. They knew him. They wanted him to succeed. There's a lot of emotional components. You need to care about the other people in the boat. You need to row for more than just yourself.
Just to be clear, Jordan, he had been rowing with these some of these other boys for 3 years.
Probably, yeah, in different configurations. Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, in different configurations, in different boats, and also, two of them had worked with him out at the Grand Coulee Dam, and he'd had this very intense bonding experience doing all this hard physical labor out on the Grand Coulee.
Right. So, and tell us a little bit about the two men who, you know, I think obviously in every great athlete's life, there's a great coach or several coaches. And for these nine boys, there were two seminal
right.
men who really helped shape them and give them the training and the kind of minds to go the whole way.
Yeah, and there were two, and they were so different. I can't think of two more different men in some ways. First, Coach Al Ulbrichtsen. Ulbrichtsen was a pretty tough guy. He was very strict. He was very reticent. He did not like to betray emotion, particularly in front of his boys and in front of sports writers. He was often called the dour Dane or the man with the stone face. And he was very intimidating. But what he was good at was that alchemy I was talking about a minute ago, that mixing and matching, trying to find the right combination. He was also a big part of the drive between their ultimate success here. He was obsessed, it was sort of a personal obsession, with going all the way to Berlin and winning that gold medal, partly because his arch rival, the coach at Cal Berkeley, Kai Ebright, had twice before won Olympic gold, and Ulbrichtsen was just determined that in 1936 he was going to go rather than Ebright. So there was a kind of a personal thing going on there. But Ulbrichtsen was very stern, very quiet. But the other huge influence on all of them was this very interesting character named George Yeoman Pocock. Pocock was a British-born boat builder. He actually grew up in the boathouse at Eton College, apprenticed to his father building racing shells for the boys that rowed for Eton. And eventually he emigrated to Canada and then wound up at the University of Washington building these exquisitely beautiful Western red cedar shells that by the mid-1930s, every collegiate program in the country was rowing in these beautiful Pocock shells.
And his shells, he made them for the entire country.
Yeah, he started by making, originally made them for the West Coast crews, and then very quickly they were so superior that every program in the country right. wanted a Pocock shell. Right. They were just beautiful. But the thing about Pocock is he was so much more than a boat builder. He was really a kind of a sage. It's interesting, he only had a middle school education, but he was deeply read in Shakespeare and Milton and all sorts of classics. And he was also a very spiritual man. And he believed that there was a spiritual sort of component to rowing. And he taught these boys to row to win, certainly. And he was a very good oarsman. He taught them to row to win, but to row for something more than that. He taught them to join the crew and to row to become part of something larger and more important than themselves. In fact, he once said, when you're rowing perfectly, you'll feel as if you've rowed off the water and are rowing amongst the stars. So he saw it as a way for these young men to elevate themselves, particularly in these hard times. And he had a tremendous impact on many of them. I think particularly on Joe, because Joe was very troubled by his past. Joe had a very difficult time trusting other people because of the way he had been treated by his family. And yet crew is a sport that's all about trust. And so Pocock was the one that was able to take Joe aside and talk to him and begin to center him and begin to get him to let himself open up to the other boys and begin to trust them. And it made all the difference in the world for Joe Rance.
What does it take? I mean, I don't know if there are a lot of rowing crew fans in the audience here, but I certainly had watched a few races but didn't know anything about it, really, prior to reading this book. And I was struck by, and I don't know, did you know much about
rowing? No, I knew zip nothing about rowing, nothing at all. I'll tell you, I worried about it a lot. The day after I met Joe and I really wanted to write this book and I was telling my wife about it, I came to a moment where I had to sort of panic because I realized, how are you going to write about a sport that you don't do? And so actually, a few weeks later, I went down to the Washington Shell House, and the freshman coach, Luke McGee, took me out in the launch. I had the opportunity to get in a boat and row, but first they took me out in the launch with the freshmen. We went out on Lake Washington, and it was a typical gray, blustery, miserable day out on Lake Washington. And I was in the coach's launch, all huddled up, trying to survive. And this boat full of these 20-year-old kids, they stripped off their shirts, and they're these big, brawny 20-year-old kids. And they're out there, and they're rowing sprints back and forth for 2 hours. And I'm thinking how much I'm suffering sitting in the launch. Then we go back in, and they get out of the shell, and they march up, and they sit down at these erg machines and start pulling on these erg machines. And I thought, I am not getting in a boat with these guys. There is no way I get in a boat with these guys. So, but what I did, the people at the Washington Shell House and a lot of other rowers got very interested in what I was doing, and they gave me an enormous amount of help learning the mechanics of the sport, learning about the experience, different kinds of experiences, rowing in a high-stakes race, rowing in rough weather, and so on. And they wound up reading drafts of the manuscript. And so, again, it was sort of collaborative in that sense. I got a lot of help from a lot of very good rowers. And we really tried to vet it very carefully to make sure it was not only technically correct, but also accurate in terms of the experiential part of it.
Good. So now I can trust what I've learned then.
I think you can. Yes. Somebody may disagree, but I...
What makes a good member of a crew? And what makes a good crew? I mean, that's sort of the question, the overarching question of the whole book, in a way.
Yeah, it is. And there's kind of, I think the answer to that is a paradox. Somebody said, I think it was a rowing coach, said a crew member has to have a big ego and a little ego at the same time. And what he meant was that it's a pretty audacious thing to want to become an Olympic rower. You have to have a lot of self-confidence and belief in yourself to go out there day after day, you know, in the very painful conditions and keep doing it. You got to be a true believer, and you got to think pretty highly of your abilities. But, as I said earlier, crew is all about melding in with others and becoming part of something larger than yourself. And that requires that you subsume your ego. Mm. And so you have to have these very interesting kinds of personalities that are capable of both, of having a large ego and yet being able at the appropriate moments to subsume that ego into the needs of this larger thing that is the crew.
It's probably a good lesson for all of us in there, right?
I suspect that's a good life lesson for pretty much any kind of endeavor, yeah.
And particularly interesting, I think, with the backdrop of the Depression, when people were learning how hard it was to go it alone.
Yep.
And then when America was radically changing its entire philosophy about sort of helping others and the government being involved and all that. So there's an interesting kind of, through this one boat, you can kind of understand a little bit about the a much deeper question.
For me, this book, when I was finished with the book, I wasn't thinking in these terms when I was writing it at all, but after I finished the book, it was off to the printer. And I was thinking about, okay, what does this mean to me? Because I knew I would be out talking about it. And it came to me as sort of a flash that I think this story of these nine young Americans who climbed in this boat and learned to pull together so beautifully and so powerfully is an almost perfect metaphor for what that whole generation of Americans did. You know, the generation we call the greatest generation. They, rowing humbles one. It teaches you humility. And I think the Depression taught humility to a whole generation of Americans. And I think that humility is in both cases what allowed them to sort of open themselves up to others and become part of something larger and form these great teams. So as I say, for me, I think it's a pretty good metaphor for how that generation learned to pull together and get, you know, great things done, build the Grand Coulee Dam, survive the Depression, win World War II on two fronts, go on and build the most prosperous era in our history. I'm a huge admirer of that generation. And so for me, this story sort of encapsulates their whole experience in some ways.
And do it all with a lot of, at least from these boys, and I think for the whole generation, a lot of kind of humility and also a kind of just kind of can-doism. There isn't a lot of fluff and kind of talking themselves up. They just kind of went out and
absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There was an absolutely a can-do kind of attitude that I remember from my parents and my uncles and my aunts. And I mean, it's not entirely dead today, but I associate it with that generation. I think they were very deeply imbued in that. And I think maybe that's because that's the way you got through the Depression and how you got through that awful war. You didn't have any choice. You just had to go do it.
I think of my 90-year-old grandfather with his duct tape trying to fix everything.
Exactly. I had uncles and like that. That's exactly right.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Daniel James Brown reads from The Boys in the Boat.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Lucas Whitman's conversation with Daniel James Brown.
We would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about what was happening in Germany, too. And you have this kind of parallel in the book. You kind of take a pause from learning about Joe and the training and the competitions to kind of take us to Germany. And over the course of these 3 years, as these boys are learning how to row, Germany is falling under the ever greater control of Hitler and the Nazi Party.
Yeah, I became almost obsessed. I mean, I always knew, I think most people know, that the 1936 Olympics were used as a propaganda tool by the Nazis. But I didn't realize the extent to which that had begun as early as 1933, 1934. I wanted readers to see what was happening behind the scenes in Germany during those years, because the show they put on, the Germans put on at the Olympics, wasn't representative of what was happening behind the scenes in Germany. So I wanted to take readers and drop them down in Germany periodically and give them telling glimpses of the kinds of things that were happening there, partly because I wanted readers at the end of the book, when they come to this big climactic gold medal race, it's largely between a German boat and an American boat in front of Hitler, I thought it was important that readers see what was at stake symbolically here. I mean, it's just a boat race on one level, okay? But symbolically, You have these two entirely different views of the world and even of civilization at stake in that race. And so I thought it was important to remind people what was going on in Germany.
And what exactly did the Nazis do to sort of hide and change the... I mean, so give us a sense of what it was like before they all the competitors arrived at the Olympics, and then kind of what it was like during the Olympics. Because I think that's a very striking difference.
Yeah, you know, they basically... these hundreds of thousands of foreigners, many of them Americans and Western Europeans, coming, were converging on one place, which is Berlin. So they focused on Berlin. And they literally got down on their hands and knees and scrubbed the streets of Berlin. But more ominously, they rounded up and carried away the entire gypsy population of Berlin, any kind of mentally defective people, homeless people. And those people all disappeared into camps. This is well before the Holocaust. Those people disappeared into camps from which they never did return. They basically turned Berlin into a movie set, a sort of fantasy version of Germany. They whitewashed decrepit old buildings. They put pots of geraniums in front of abandoned apartments to make them look occupied. They draped the Nazi flags everywhere. It was just this, it was as if you were decorating a set. Because in large part it was. Leni Riefenstahl, the great German filmmaker, who was a very interesting character in herself, was going to document not only the games but also life in Berlin during those years. And so her cameras were everywhere in Berlin and at all the venues for the Olympics. And it turned into a large movie shoot on one level.
Right, and even further, they took down signs about forbidding Jews to go
exactly.
Here and there.
There were signs forbidding Jews to go here and there. There were signs encouraging Jews to speed up around dangerous curves on the roadways. There were just extraordinarily offensive things going on. And all that disappeared for the few weeks that summer that these hundreds of thousands of foreigners were in town.
Now, were Americans aware of all this? I mean, I know that's one of those great debates about the Holocaust and about the Second World War, is when did we know and how much did we all know? But, you know, it seems that basically they were hoodwinked about what was happening.
The most Americans...
Or allowed themselves to be.
Yeah, or allowed themselves to be, exactly. And a couple of things. Most Americans who went to Berlin that summer came back feeling very good about Germany, with very positive reports about Germany, because what they saw wasn't really what was happening in Germany. However, it is also... And actually, a poll at the University of Washington that summer, 99% of the students said they didn't want any kind of foreign involvement in whatever happened in Germany. So there was a very great willingness to not see what was happening, and then the Germans aided that by creating this fantasy version. But you have to remember that there were, in fact, hundreds of thousands of Americans in the Jewish community, particularly in New York, who had relatives in Europe. They were hearing what was beginning to happen. Now, the Holocaust hadn't happened yet, but very ominous things were happening. So the Jewish community in America was very alarmed by 1936, extremely alarmed, and as you may know, tried to organize a boycott of the games, and that got knocked down, basically.
Yeah, because the Olympic Games are meant to be, as we all know, it's fraught. Corrupt process, but meant to be this kind of great spirit of inclusiveness and nations competing at the highest levels and bringing peace and all that. And so it seems totally at odds that they would have a country that was rounding up people, that they'd have the Olympics there.
Absolutely.
And yet, so why'd the boycott fail?
The boycott failed largely, in my opinion, through the offices of Avery Brundage, who was the chairman of the International Olympic Committee. Brundage was, I think it's pretty clear now in retrospect, that he was an anti-Semite, and he used his powers to suppress the boycott movement. and succeeded in it. It was just pretty much brutal power politics within the Olympic Committee.
And did the boys have any sense? The crew have any sense of what was going on, or what it meant to be there? Or?
You know, I think they had a general sense that Hitler was some kind of a weird dictator. I mean, you know, there was a sense that Hitler was bad, but nobody really knew, you know, how bad yet. And so when the boys went, they largely had the same impression that other Americans did. They came back thinking, well, Germany seems like a pretty reasonable place. Now, within a few years, every one of them had changed their mind about that, of course, when the reality began to become visible.
When they all went off to serve in various ways.
And they went off,
ways.
Yeah, exactly.
And did you get any sense retrospectively? I mean, when you're talking to Joe, did he kind of realize just how incredible it had been to be rowing in front of Hitler and taking on the kind of...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, within a few years, they could see the horror unfolding, and they realized they had been in Hitler's presence. It's actually kind of a cute little anecdote. When Hitler entered for the opening ceremonies, Hitler came marching through a corridor of troops into the stadium, and very impressive sight. But the athletes were arrayed outside the stadium on lawns. And most of the athletes from different countries around the world were standing at attention as Hitler came in. The American kids were lying on the lawn, and they sort of waved at him as he went by. The American boys also had another joke. They thought the Heil Hitler thing was pretty funny. So when they walk around Berlin, people would do this Heil Hitler thing to them, and they learned to respond by saying, well, Heil Roosevelt.
Speaking of Roosevelt, there's this wonderful scene which to me captured something that would certainly not be possible today, involving Roosevelt's youngest son. And Roosevelt himself was a big fan of crewing. I don't know if you want to tell us that story.
Two of his sons rowed, and he was a huge fan of crew. But just before the big regatta in Poughkeepsie in 1936, this de facto national championship, the boys had an evening off, and the coach let them borrow the coaching launch. And so they were trying to figure out what to do with their evening, and they knew Hyde Park, the Roosevelt's summer residence, was just up the river. So they decided they were going to go visit the president. And they did, or they tried. They took the launch, they went up the river to Hyde Park, they got off, they didn't know exactly where the house was, so they wandered around in the woods, and finally a gardener pointed out the house to them. They marched up to the front door and knocked on the door, and one of Roosevelt's sons answered, and the president was in D.C. that day. But the son let them in and sat them down in the parlor of Hyde Park, and had a good, he was a rower too, so they had a good long chat about rowing, and then they went home. But the audacity of marching up to the president's door and knocking on it.
Now you'd get shot.
Yeah exactly.
tell us, I mean, just to go back a little bit, how good were they? I mean, especially reading your book, it's clear they were better than anyone else in the country, but looking back, maybe you should tell people a little bit about, you know, sort of how they set the records they set and all of that. I think it's important to get some context.
In Berlin in 1936, they had to, the crew they feared the most in terms of competition was the British crew, boys from Oxford and Cambridge rowing for the Leander Club. They were supposed to be the best crew in the world.
Which, just for those pop culture people out there, I don't know if you're any fans of House with Hugh Laurie.
Yeah.
His father was in that boat.
Yes, right.
For England. He was the stroke.
Yeah, Ran Laurie was the stroke for this British boat. And he was probably the greatest stroke oar of his generation in Britain. Very good boat. So to get to the gold medal round, the Americans had to row against the British in the preliminary round. And they beat the British in that race, but they set both an Olympic and a world record to do it. And it was an extraordinary race, extraordinarily close. It had the British, I think, unfortunately, it was such a hard road race that from the British point of view, they never really recovered from it because they had to come back, I don't remember, one day or 2 days later and row in the gold medal race. And they just, the British couldn't get the energy back up again and didn't do very well in the gold medal race. But they were extraordinarily fast. Now, I have to say that I think they were arguably, certainly one of the, I could say the best collegiate crew of all time, but you could get very, you know, down in the weeds about that. Certainly one of the top few collegiate crews of all time. I also have to say that crews these days turn in much faster times. That's because the athletes now are much bigger and bulkier than they were in the 1930s. If you look at pictures of these kids from Washington, they're just, you can see their ribs. They're just tall bean poles. The kids that row nowadays are big, bulky. Both the men and the women are very...
they have nutritionists and...
Exactly.
They lots of staff telling them what to eat, how to work out.
Yeah. Exactly. And erg machines. It's all very scientific. So the rowers are bigger and brawnier now. And just as importantly, the boats are much lighter now. These guys were rowing in these beautiful but relatively heavy cedar shells. And nowadays they row in these very light carbon fiber shells. So they turn in much faster times now.
I wanted to return, just we had discussed a little earlier, but it's something that I think that we've maybe lost a little bit of here. But you know, I'm really getting dangerous territory here. Talking about college sports and in Michigan country here, but I did want to, because I did think there was something, and you see this when you're talking about any number of college sports from this generation, which is that there was less of this kind of, there was no real kind of corporate involvement. It was kind of boys going out there and trying their best and learning, becoming a kind of team or a crew together, and I think it was an interesting thing that I think we've lost some of that here in a way.
Yeah, I mean, these guys were, several things. Like, even now, the University of Washington, they recruit rowers from Romania and New Zealand and all over the place. These were, as I said, largely farm kids from Western Washington that walked onto the crew, first of all. But there was also, they were amateurs in the deepest sense of the word. I mean, there was no financial glory or gain at all in this, except keeping a job at the University of Washington so that you could go to school. And when you compare it to both college athletics and professional athletics now, it's an entirely different world. Nobody was promoting this crew on television or anywhere else. There was radio coverage of it, and the radio coverage was tuned into by millions of people. But that was just generated by the popularity of the sport itself. So there was not very little in the way of institutional support. Mm-hmm. And in fact, after the Olympics, these nine guys, Wheaties, General Mills, I suppose, wanted them to put their image on the Wheaties box, and were going to pay them, I don't know, whatever it was. And they turned it, all nine of them said no, they didn't want any part of that.
Mm. Wow.
As I say, during times when a little bit of money would have gone a long way.
In terms of the popularity of the sport, I was really surprised at just how popular crew was then. I mean, you had at the Poughkeepsie Regattas, you had tens of thousands of people turning up, even just to watch Washington row.
Yeah.
And the numbers are just, I mean, they're equivalent to college football games today in terms of people actually showing up.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Poughkeepsie. At regattas, various places in the country, 70, 80, 90,000 people would turn out. Out on Lake Washington in Seattle on a Saturday afternoon, you get 70, 80,000 people out for a regatta. People would fill the ferry boats. They'd line ferry boats up and other small vessels along the race course. They'd have an observation train running parallel to the race course, both in Poughkeepsie and in Seattle. Huge crowds, and that would be a Saturday afternoon would be to go to see the crew races.
So what happened?
Well, a couple things. I mean, or actually one big thing, I think. you know, we have 80 channels or whatever it is now of sports to watch, and we have big business, as you were just saying. We have the, you know, the NFL and the NBA and these huge institutions promoting their sports, and there's just too much competition for the eyeballs. The other thing I have to say is that watching a crew race from the shore is sometimes it's very exciting, but it's not always very exciting. There are times, you know, if you watch the boats and they come down and they go by, and you may or may not know who won the race, and it's a little hard to get whooped up about it. But what I would say about that is that, and one of the things I tried to do in the book is to see it from the athlete's point of view. So much of the drama in the crew race takes place between the gunwales of the boat. So much of it takes place in the boat. That one of the things I really wanted to do with the book was drop you down in one of those seats and make you experience one of these races from that viewpoint. Because there was a lot of drama seen from the boat.
Talk us through a little bit of the process of how you, because you do get us into the boat, and I was very impressed by that, and I think people will be, how'd you get in there? I mean, you talked to them, but you sat in the boat yourself, you rowed.
Just enough to feel what it feels like, yeah.
The pain and...
not enough of the pain to be able to, but boy, I heard a lot about pain, believe me. You have to remember that because the sport was so popular in those days that there was a huge amount of press coverage of it. For any one of these races, I could find dozens of very long articles detailing all the events leading up to the race and then exactly what was going on in each boat during the race. And then, of course, having the diaries of some of these guys also, they were able to give firsthand accounts of what they were thinking and what they were feeling at different moments in the race. So there just was a lot of first-hand and second-hand observation of what was happening that I could draw on.
And there's a remarkable stat that you have in the book, which is that, I believe this is just for the final racing season for the boys, but they had rowed 4,344 miles.
I think that's right, yeah.
Which is sort of like Seattle to Tokyo, basically.
Well, just about.
More or less. Each given around 469,000 strokes,
yep,
give or take. And that was all just for 28 miles of actual competitive racing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about crew then and now, for these guys, there were only three or four major races in a year, which meant that every race was very, very high stakes. So they would practice for endless hours out on Lake Washington for just a few minutes of actual racing time. And as I say, that's part of what ratcheted the drama up, was that they didn't have time to make mistakes or have a second try at it. It was all on the line every time they raced.
Right. And how did that make the boys feel? I mean, that kind of pressure, that competition.
You know, I think it made them nervous, especially when they were freshmen, when they were first starting. You can see in the things they wrote about it that there was a lot of tension. I think, and there was all the way through, certainly before the gold medal race in Berlin, there was a lot of anxiety, particularly because the stroke oar was so ill and there were all kinds of things going wrong. But I do think they got more centered as they got older and got to be a better crew. And I think that I think they actually learned to sort of, and Pocock was a part of this, learned to center themselves and be much less anxious and just sort of assume that they were going to win these races. They tended, as a bunch of people, they tended to have very positive expectations of what was going to happen. Mm.
Mm. And did they have any rituals? I always like reading about athletes' rituals, what they do before a game.
Not that I'm aware of.
No. Okay. Another thing with these athletes is you always wonder what it was like afterwards. You read, talk to Olympic athletes or read about them, and especially the Olympic athletes, but also pro athletes. And that was, you know, there are those moments that are the high points of their life, and it can be very, very hard to kind of live a normal life and raise kids and all of that. And yet these nine men seem to have done that with a certain amount of...
They did, with one exception. It was very interesting. Partly because... eight of them were very humble, and I'll talk about the ninth in a second. 8 of them were conspicuously humble. Those guys came home and they stuck their gold medals in sock drawers. And because it was the Depression, they had to immediately go out and get a job to try to get through another year of school. And so they just went about their business. Some of them never bothered to tell their kids about the gold medal until much later in life. But the exception was Bobby Mock, the coxswain. And Bob, his daughter Marilyn, told me while I was in the process of interviewing her about her father. She said that Bob never really got over it, in the sense that it was the most exciting, fulfilling thing he had ever done. And she said he spent the rest of his life trying to find something that would match it for sheer impact on him. And it was kind of a problem. I mean, Bob Mock was a pretty driven guy, and he wasn't a particularly humble guy.
And he went on to be a very successful
lawyer. Yes, he became a very successful lawyer, yes, in Seattle, and argued cases at the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact. So, but he was, according to Marilyn, his daughter, he was the only one of them that really actively tried to promote what had happened. For the rest of his life, he would tell anybody, and he'd try to get articles written, and he was constantly trying to keep the story alive. But as I say, it sort of took a toll on him, because he never really found anything quite that intense again.
And arguably, he was the one who really made it happen.
Yeah, arguably he was. You know, I mean, Bob Mock's one of the most interesting characters in the book,
as far as I'm concerned.
So Bob Mock was coxswains, of course, if you don't row or don't know rowing, coxswains are the relatively short person who sits in the back of the boat and steers it, and also gives commands, basically, to the rest of the crew. And Bob Mock was a very smart fellow, and he was not above both defying his coach and lying to his crew in order to make things come out the way he wanted. And there's a wonderful race in 1936 in Poughkeepsie in which he did both. I won't tell you too much in case you haven't read it, but he outright defied Ulbrichtsen in terms of what he was supposed to be doing out on the river, and yet he made it work. So he was just, you know, he was one of these characters that is just irresistible to a writer, I think. Tenacious. You know, he was 5'7", which is how tall I am. And in high school, he went out for basketball, and he lettered in basketball. And I remember hiding from basketball all the way through school. Like, the last thing, just don't make me play basketball. But he was that kind. He was going to, if there was something that was challenging, he was going to try to do it.
And I wonder, we're just going to wrap it up here, but a few more. One, I wonder what you learned writing this book. I mean, from guys like Bobby Mock, and from that kind of, what was the sort of, when you were done, what was the kind of feeling you were left with about these individuals and what they had done together?
Yeah, you know, it turned out to be so much more than I thought. I mean, I sort of went into thinking it was a really cool sports story, and it turned into so much more than a sports story. I think the most important thing, actually, I'll read here a passage in just a second that touches on this. The most important thing, I think, is what I said a little earlier, that about this generation and the extraordinary qualities that they developed. And I came away humbled myself by feeling somewhat inadequate in comparison to what these guys had done. I mean, my life's been happy and successful, and I'm not going to try to second guess that, but these guys are almost godlike to me when I sit back and I look at what they did and contemplate the circumstances in which they did it, the things they overcame in order to get where they were trying to go. So I found it very humbling, and just I admire them enormously.
That's great. Well, Daniel, would you like to read for us a little bit?
Yeah, I have one passage.
Thank you.
So while I was working on the book, towards near the end of the project, I wanted to go to Berlin. Actually, not to Berlin, but to Grunau, this little village south of Berlin on the Langer See, which is where the race course was. I wanted to see it if I was going to write about it, of course, and I hadn't been able to do that up to that point. So before I wrote the Berlin stuff and the gold medal race, I went to Germany and I went out to Grunau, and I had an opportunity to go up on the balcony where Hitler stood. And I just want to read you what went through my mind that day as I was there, because it sort of sums up what I was just saying about how I feel about this generation. I'll start here. In Grunau, I found the regatta grounds little changed from 1936. A large electronic reader board now dominates the area near the finish line, but otherwise the place looks much as it does in the old newsreels and photographs. The neighborhood is still lovely, green and leafy. The covered grandstands still rise near the finish line. The longer sea is still placid and tranquil. Earnest young men and women in racing shells still ply its waters in racing lanes laid down just as they were in 1936. I visited the Wassersports Museum in Grunau, where late in the afternoon, Werner Philipp, the director, kindly led me up a set of stairs to the balcony of House Vest. I stood there for a long time, a long quiet minute, near where Hitler stood 75 years before, gazing out over the longer sea, seeing it much as he saw it. Down below me, young men were unloading a shell from a truck, singing something softly in German, and preparing for an evening row. Out on the water, a single sculler, his blade glinting, worked his way down one of the lanes towards the large Ziel sign at the end of the course. Closer to me, swallows flew low over the water on silent wings, silhouetted against the declining sun, touching the water from time to time, dimpling the silver surface. Standing there, watching them, it occurred to me that when Hitler watched Joe and the boys fight their way back from the rear of the field to sweep ahead of Italy and Germany 75 years ago, he saw but did not recognize the heralds of his doom. He could not have known that one day hundreds of thousands of boys just like them, boys who shared their essential natures, decent and unassuming, not privileged or favored by anything in particular, just loyal, committed, and perseverant, would return to Germany, dressed in olive drab, hunting him down. They are almost all gone now, the legions of young men who saved the world in the years just before I was born. But that afternoon, standing on the balcony of House Vest, I was swept with gratitude for their goodness and their grace, their humility and their honor, their simple civility, and all the things they taught us before they flitted across the evening water and finally vanished into the night.
That was Daniel James Brown at the National Writers Series talking with Lucas Whitman. Next time on the broadcast, Karen Slaughter. She's one of crime fiction's most celebrated award-winning writers. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.